This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's been a rough week for the president. On the same day that he failed to reach his long-desired denuclearization agreement with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, his former personal attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, blasted him before a congressional panel. And Trump took a position on the death of a local man, formerly imprisoned in North Korea, that takes the side of Kim, whom he called a friend. Plus, the field of Democrats vying to replace Trump next year grew by one big name. Senator Bernie Sanders is running again, and for many on the left, their feelings for the burn never burned out. What are his chances this time around? Abortion is making a comeback as a top issue for Republicans at the national and state level. What do we make of that? And the Green New Deal, is it a blessing or a curse for the Democrats? We explore those topics and more with the political junkie Ken Rudin, who joins us on the phone. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, Michael. Great to be starting to work with you, if that was English.
It was close enough. Good, yeah. Welcome to the show. Yeah. Excited to chat. We've also got you here. I'm giggling over here. WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Welcome back, Howard.
Thank you, sir.
All right. So before we dive in, I understand there's some trivia involved when we get together and do this show. So, Ken, what's today's trivia question?
Well, Michael and Howard, of course, Howard has already written down the answer.
Have we lost Ken? Okay, we'll get Ken back on, and after he joins us again, we'll get that trivia question, because we want to hear from you who are listening. You'll get the opportunity to call in and try to give us the correct answer, and if you're correct, you get some fancy little political junkie button.
You get his button, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So you
much
want that.
Sought over, yeah.
It's a collector's item. Yeah. 513-419.
What's going on here?
Oh, you there, Ken?
What's going on?
Oh, we apologize. We must have had some type of technical difficulty, but we're glad you're back. So
the gerbil died or something. Yeah.
Well, he's running on that wheel again. And when last we left you, we were about to hear today's trivia question.
Well, Michael Cohen's testimony yesterday reminded some, including me, of Watergate. So I have a Watergate-related trivia question, and that is: There were three people who worked on the Senate Watergate Committee in 1973, who later ran for president. Of the three who ran for president, who got the most votes?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Do you know the answer? Howard's going to write his down. And if you want to weigh in, 513-419-7100. We can only take your answers to the trivia question on the phone line. No emails, 513-419-7100. Also, if you have any questions or comments about the politics of the week, you can email talk@wvxu.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there. So let's jump into the topics for the day. President Trump, he wrote the book, The Art of the Deal. Did he not read it before heading to North Korea and coming home empty-handed? What happened?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, probably he had high expectations. Look, he always sees himself as this great deal maker, but I don't know why he ever thought that Kim Jong-un would have agreed to get rid of nuclear weapons. Now, of course, that was a little bit much to ask for, but what Kim did ask for was in exchange for stopping the testing of ballistic missiles, that the U.S. should now end the sanctions against North Korea with an R. And Trump and the president said that was not on the table. And basically, he just, I don't know if he stormed out, but he certainly left without a deal.
So what did the president think he was going to accomplish, do we think?
Well, you know something, the weirdest thing is that he, in comments, I guess a week or so ago, in the outside the Oval Office on the West Lawn, he basically was talking about the Nobel Peace Prize. He said that, you know, the Prime Minister of Japan nominated me, the South Korean president also wanted me. So, I mean, it's probably not going to happen, but I would, be interesting if I got the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, which is so beyond belief, given the fact that only a year ago he was talking about Rocket Man and my nuclear weapons and my buttons are bigger than your buttons. And he was basically threatening to wipe North Korea off the face of the earth. And then he goes to try to work out some kind of a deal regarding limiting nuclear weapons. And so, I don't know, the thought of a Nobel Peace Prize might be a little bit out of the realm of possibility.
But Howard, that's not out of the realm of possibility necessarily for the president, who likes adulation.
Well, yeah. No, absolutely. But
it just mystifies me why he would think that after all of this, what Ken has told us, that the leader of North Korea would roll over and play dead for him. And he's not going to do that. He's not in a position where he has to. And I don't know, you know, the man who wrote The Art of the Deal never ran into a guy like this.
And now he has.
Two things were interesting. First of all, before he even got there, this is probably my favorite part of everything. Before he got there, he did it. He launched a tweet. He didn't launch a missile, but he launched a tweet. Mm-hmm. He talked about Danang Dick Blumenthal, the senator from Connecticut, who may have embellished some of his time when he was in Vietnam during the war. But he basically talked about Danang Dick Blumenthal. This is a president who had bone spurs, alleged bone spurs, to keep him out of the draft. He's attacking other people for what they may or may not have done while they were actually in Vietnam.
So this summit happened in Vietnam, and that's where Trump was. And there were a lot of references to the fact that Trump did not go to Vietnam. He is of that age where he could have probably served in the military, but received those deferments. But that sort of speaks to the president's brazenness, that he's willing to I guess stand up to that very obvious hypocrisy in calling out someone who did serve in the military in the Vietnam era when he did not. So what role does that brazenness and that attitude that he has about himself play in these negotiations with somebody like Kim Jong-un?
Well, I mean, look, it's very interesting that, remember, not too long ago, he was talking about that he and Kim Jong-un fell in love. We fell in love together. It's interesting how he always disparages U.S. allies in France, in Germany, in Britain, in Mexico, in Canada, and of course, Republicans even in Congress. But people, autocratic leaders, like the head of Turkey, like Putin in Russia, and of course, Kim in North Korea, that we fell in love and we can get along together. And it's just pretty remarkable how he sees himself and how he sees reality. Now, look, I mean, the fact that North Korea has not launched a missile in at least a year, is that correct? I mean, that mm-hmm. is advancement. That is good news. That is something to you know, write home about. But what he expected, the thought of Kim giving up his nuclear arsenal, I think that was just never a possibility to begin with.
All right, let's remind everybody about today's trivia question. Three people who worked on the 1973 Senate Watergate Committee later ran for president. Which one got the most votes in their party's primaries? That's it. If you know the answer, 513-419-7100. We await your calls and your answers. Historically, we've had presidents meet with foreign leaders who may have been viewed as adversaries, but have we ever before had a president refer to such an adversary as his friend?
No, I mean, this is absolutely incredible. And the stuff with Putin, you know, where he took his side against the U.S. intelligence services was just unbelievable. And John McCain, before he passed away, was highly critical. So, you know, this is just... he basically said it was almost treasonous to do something like that to the U.S. intelligence community.
And Trump took the side of Kim on an issue that hits very close to home here in Cincinnati, the death of college student Otto Warmbier, who was a prisoner in North Korea and died when he was brought back.
That's certainly not going to win him any friends in this area, because that death was taken very hard by a lot of people.
So
here,
Trump agreed with Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, that the Russian government did not interfere in the 2016 elections, even though that goes against the reporting and national intelligence. And now he takes the side of Kim Jong-un, that Kim claims that he did not know anything about the treatment of Otto Warmbier in prison, and says that he believes that. What does that tell us about these relationships that he has with these key adversaries?
I think it tells us that they're very shallow and that they're very much based on his predilections towards, you know, these so-called strongmen. And, you know, I mean, he just tends to believe them and not believe others.
Okay. We've got a question, it looks like, from Garrett on the line. Garrett, what's your question?
Hello?
Hi, Garrett. Go ahead. Garrett.
Yeah, Ottawambia, I know you were just talking about it, but I haven't heard from his parents as to Trump's trip to North Korea. I know that Trump said that Kim Jong-un did not know about the situation with Otto and feel sad about it, but I just can't find that credible. And I don't know if, I know Rick Santorum this morning criticized Trump for these words, and I'm just wondering what your guests have to say about it. I know Wambier's parents are filing a legal suit for $500 million.
That's right.
To North Korea.
All right, Garrett, we'll hang up and let the guys weigh in. Ken, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I mean, I don't even know what to say. It's a combination of the fact that the president is always been susceptible to praise and adulation, and usually much of that praise has come from the more autocratic kind of rulers around the world, as I said, in Turkey and the Philippines and Russia and things like that. So when he's swooning over his relationship with a leader who may not be the most democratic leader in the world, but the fact that he's established a good rapport with him, Trump has always seemed to take their side. Look at what went on with the Khashoggi killing. He'll still take Saudi Arabia's word. He'll still say that the crown prince, I believe him. He said that he had nothing to do with it, and I believe him when everybody on the face of the earth is convinced that the crown prince Salman, was responsible, or at least had a huge part in the killing and the dismembering of Khashoggi in Turkey. So, I mean, this is what the president does. He takes the word, and as Howard mentioned in Helsinki, that thing last year when before the whole world, he said, well, I know the U.S. intelligence agencies say that Russia was involved, but I asked Putin, and he said to my face that he didn't have any involvement, and that's good enough for me. It's, you know, Michael, in answer to that question, I've never, you know, the old Ronald Reagan trust but verify. This president believes in trust and very little effort for verification.
513-419-7100 if you want to weigh in on what we're talking about or today's trivia question. Three people who worked on the 1973 Senate Watergate Committee later ran for president. Which one of those three got the most votes in their primaries? We'll take some of the calls after this short break. We continue with political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. In just a moment, you're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with the political junkie, Ken Rudin, who joins us on the phone, and WVXU senior political analyst, Howard Wilkinson. He's here in the studio. But first, we're going to go to the phones and see if anyone has the correct answer to today's trivia question. Three people who worked on the 1973 Senate Watergate Committee later ran for president. Which one of those three got the most votes in the primary? So we're going to go to the phones, and we will start with Robert. Hey, Robert, what's your guess?
Mine is Frank Church.
Frank Church. Ken?
Well, Frank Church was on a different Senate investigating committee. He was investigating CIA abuses in the 1970s. And Frank Church did run for president, a Democrat from Idaho. He ran in 1976. But Frank Church was not on the Senate Watergate Committee.
Good guess, Robert, but not correct. Okay, let's go to Cassandra. You're on the air. What's your guess?
Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton. Ken?
Well, this is a great guess, and I'll tell you why it's a great guess, because Hillary Clinton did work on the House Judiciary Committee in 1974 under Peter Rodino when they brought up articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. Hillary Clinton did work for the House Judiciary Committee during impeachment, ran for president twice, but she did not work on the Senate Watergate Committee. That's a great guess, though.
It's also worth noting that she was not a member of the House. She was a staff person.
There you go, well, Cassandra.
I didn't say that it has to be a member of the House.
Oh, I know.
I just said somebody who worked on the committee.
Yeah, I know.
So that's why it was a good guess.
Okay, but, Cassandra, thank you for your answer. And John, you're on the air. What was your guess? Do we have John? Okay, honestly, John and a couple of others, producer Pete Reitmeier had their answers, and they were also Hillary Clinton, so it looks like when they heard that it was incorrect, they all hung up. So
that was a great guess, though.
It was a great guess, so we're still waiting for a correct response. If you know what it is, you can give us a call at 513-419-7100, and we'll take that call. When last we left you, we were talking about Otto Warmbier and the death of this locally based college student after he returned home from being held prisoner in North Korea. I think we've got a question from Nicole. She's on the line. Nicole, what's your question?
Hi, it was actually more of a comment in thinking about how President Trump is really believing dictators at their word. You know, the thing that's fishy to me is people often do for others what they want done for themselves. And given all the questions of, you know, Trump's participation with, you know, Russia and in the election, you know, it just makes me wonder if he is doing these things because he believes that trusting people on their word for things like questionable situations is a plausible and a reasonable excuse. And so by putting on a face of trusting Kim Jong-un and President Putin, that people should be doing the same for him because it's a fair and reasonable thing to do.
Thanks for your comment, Nicole. And Howard, you were speaking just before we came back about why we haven't heard from Otto Warmbier's parents yet since Donald Trump said yesterday or early this morning that he agreed or believed Kim Jong-un when the Korean dictator said that he didn't know anything about the treatment of Otto Warmbier.
Well, I don't know, but I'm sure that the Warmbiers probably disagree with the president, but they're not in a position to be able to respond to it publicly because of the lawsuit that they have filed against the North Korean government over the death of their son. And that pretty much renders them silent on these issues because they're going to have their day in court.
They seem to be somewhat grateful for the way the president treated the family
and the
urgency with which he treated the Otto Warmbier situation when it was happening.
That is very true.
You would be making an assumption, of course, but do you think that that relationship or feelings may have changed since this morning?
It might have. I mean, you know, I could see where it could. But yeah, you're absolutely right. They were grateful to him at the time. But it didn't, you know, obviously have anything to do with stopping a lawsuit against the North Korean government.
All right. So we will be moving on to talk about the Michael Cohen testimony that took place yesterday. But first, let's get some more answers to our trivia question. Three people who worked on the 1973 Senate Watergate Committee later ran for president. Which one of those three got the most votes in the primary? Let's go to Mike. You're on the air. What's your guess?
Howard Baker.
Ken.
Well, Howard Baker is the most logical guess because he did run for president in 1980, but he dropped out shortly after the New Hampshire primary. He did run for president, but he's not the one who got the most votes in the primaries.
Good guess, though, Mike. Very well done.
Yes. Right.
Okay, we've got...
Was that Howard's guess?
I don't know yet. Hey, Barbara.
No. Okay.
What was your guess, Barbara?
George H.W. Bush.
George H.W. Bush. Ken.
Well, in Watergate back then, George H.W. Bush, believe it or not, was the chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was not working on the Senate Watergate Committee.
Good guess, Barbara. Not the right one, though. Okay, let's move over to Diane. You had a guess.
I did have a guess of Howard Baker.
Oh, and we just found out that
I can't think of anyone else.
It was a great guess.
You.
Great guess, just not correct. Yeah. All right, and we were going to go to Richard. Richard, what's your guess?
Well, hi. The name that popped into my head was Senator Fred Thompson.
Fred Thompson?
Well, Fred Thompson, believe it or not, is the correct answer.
Very good, Richard.
And the reason I love that question is because, unlike Howard Baker and unlike Lowell Weicker, who also ran for president later, Fred Thompson was not a senator at the time. He was the chief counsel for the minority side Howard Baker. He ran for president in 2008 and got some like 300,000 votes in the primaries. Fred Thompson is the correct answer.
Well done, Richard. Stay on the line. And Pete, our producer, is going to take care of you and get you that very highly coveted political junkie button coming your way. I mean, a lot of us of a younger generation don't know Fred Thompson from Watergate. We know him from Law and Order.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It was very good on Law and Order.
All right. If you want to weigh in on the issues of the day, let's go 513-419-7100. Email talk@wvxu.org or check us out on Facebook or Twitter. And I forgot to do one thing. We had to check in with Howard Wilkinson here on what his answer was. Let's see it, Howard.
Oh, easily.
I'll be darned. He had written down Fred Thompson. This guy's a genius. So, Ken, he got it again.
I say we keep Howard.
Let's keep him. We'll keep him
on
staff.
Yeah. Thanks, Ken.
Yeah.
Okay, so Michael Cohen, the former personal attorney of the president and his so-called personal fixer, testified before the House Oversight Committee on Wednesday. Did we learn anything that we didn't know already?
Well, I mean, there were so many ways of answering that question. What we did learn is that the depth to now, first of all, we have to let's not dismiss the Republican arguments from the beginning that Michael Cohen is an admitted liar. He's been disbarred. He's going to prison for lying to Congress. Having said that, I found his testimony absolutely credible, unlike every Republican, except maybe Justin Amash from Michigan, who I thought was very impressive yesterday. But the point is, what we did learn was all the things that President Trump had his hands in, and this, you know, the hush money, the efforts to avoid the draft, all the things that he said he did about taxes and his net worth. I think if you've been following these stories, a lot, you kind of feel that we've heard this all before. But just to hear it in one, albeit a long 7.5 hours worth of it, it was just kind of damning and basically wrote a case that could lead, or at least shall we say that clearly that other investigators are looking into quite thoroughly. But there's a lot of things there, and it was pretty damning.
I mean, this man is clearly no angel, and he is going to prison for 3 years, and he's done a lot of things that he should not have done. But that doesn't mean he was lying about everything in those 7.5 hours of testimony. The bottom line, I think, of the thing is the man has a check that was written by Donald Trump, and that's evidence. That's evidence that can be used in a criminal case.
Yeah, we'll have to see if that works, because the president, while he was in Vietnam with his meeting with Kim Jong-un, there was a tweet from Jim Acosta of CNN who said that the president, during the news conference following the abrupt closure of that summit, that Trump did not call on any of the typical White House correspondents and instead called on a couple of foreign state news agencies, even called on Sean Hannity, the Fox News host. But it seemed that he wanted to avoid questions about the Cohen case, which is strange because he had a lot to say after Cohen's opening statement was released to the public, but he didn't want to say anything after. Why do we think that is?
Well, I mean, for the same reason that his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, wanted to talk about the mistakes that Michael Cohen has made during his life and what he's going to prison for. And Trump's sons have done the same thing. You know, they keep piling on about, you know, well, he's a proven liar. He was trying to become chief of staff. He's can't be trusted. But as I said, it doesn't mean that he was lying about what he testified about.
And not one Republican refuted a single thing that Michael Cohen said.
Even Jim Jordan.
Well, basically, Jim Jordan, I mean, everybody's focus, I thought it was just fascinating, everybody's focus was on what Michael Cohen and his past. But and those who tried to defend Trump, I thought this was very remarkable when Mark Meadows, the congressman from North Carolina, in response to Michael Cohen saying that President Trump is a racist, he said, well, I just happened to have this black woman. It's like a Marshall McLuhan scene from Annie Hall. But I just happened to have this black woman here who works for HUD. How could he be racist if you have this African-American woman here who works for HUD?
And Michael Cohen claimed responsibility for Lynn Patton, the woman who works at the Housing and Urban Development Federal Department, claimed responsibility for getting her that job. And there was a very interesting exchange there between Mark Meadows, the Republican from North Carolina, and Representative Rashida Tlaib, the Democrat from Michigan. Rashida Tlaib didn't call Meadows a racist, but said using this woman, Lynn Patton, as a political prop was a racist act. And that ended up being a very intriguing exchange. Let's go back to the phones. We've got William on the line. William, you have a question or comment? Hi, William. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. What's your question or comment?
My comment was there was the comment earlier about the warm beers remaining silent with respect to the statement by Trump believing Kim, the North Koreans about not having knowledge. And it was motivated by the lawsuit. And my understanding is that lawsuit, there was a judgment in December for $500 million. So I think that sort of undermines that as the motivation, because I believe that's over. I think the real issue is whether they'll collect.
Yeah, because it's a judgment against a foreign entity. So
yes, it is a judgment against a foreign entity, and
but that's a good clarification.
But you're right about that. But whether or not they will ever see a dime out of it, that is an open question.
Thank you for the call, William. Okay, so I want to jump back into the Cohen testimony because.
Can I just add one more thing about Mark Meadows, because I think it's kind of significant. So after Rashida Tlaib went on and said, well, this feels racist to me that this woman they brought out seems like a prop. And he said, how dare you? I want your words stricken down. How dare you accuse me of racism? And shortly after, or within minutes of that exchange, lo and behold, everybody found a tape of Mark Meadows campaigning for Congress in 2012, where he said, let's send Barack Obama back to Kenya or wherever he's from.
Yeah, that's so exactly right.
For all the I doth protest too much about my racism, they came up with this video, which I thought was quite instructive.
And there was also a lot of criticism about the exchange just in general, because, the chairman of the committee was Elijah Cummings. He's a black man, and Rashida Tlaib is a black woman, and there seemed to be this weirdness where two black people were forced to apologize in some way for suggesting that a white man could be racist. And so the whole thing ended up becoming a thing in and of itself in this very important testimony. One other member of the House Oversight Committee happens to be Northern Kentucky's own Republican Congressman Thomas Massie. And I thought that Thomas Massie had a very interesting week, Howard, because two issues involving President Trump all in the same week, he was kind of on different sides, and it's easy to kind of get whiplash following Massie around during the age of Trump. So first, he was one of just a handful of Republicans who voted against Trump's national emergency declaration to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. But he was on this panel asking questions of Cohen, and Massie called Cohen the least credible witness ever to appear before the House Oversight Committee. How do we follow Massie in this age?
That's a really good question, because you can't. He is all over the map, and I think he's sincere in his beliefs. When he'll vote for Trump on some things, he'll vote against him on other things. He'll say things like that in a committee hearing. That covers a lot of ground if he's talking about the history of House Oversight Committee and saying that this is the worst. But, that's Tom Massie.
But something? Here's what was bugged me. I mean, all the Republicans, the Republican line basically yesterday was, I can't believe that in the first week or the first month of the new Congress, this is what we spend time on. We could be curing cancer, but instead We're focusing on Donald Trump and trying to tear down this president. Nobody mentioned the fact that the Republicans spent millions of dollars on a Benghazi hearing that basically was faulty from the beginning and got nowhere, but they spent millions and millions of dollars on it. Suddenly they're worried about taxpayer money, and suddenly they're worried about, you know, hurting the president while he's overseas.
I think it was a kind of a major fail for the Republicans on that committee all the way around. And part of it had to do with the last 2 or 3 minutes in the final statement that Cohen made, where he said, look, you know, I did some very terrible things, and I'm going to prison, and I deserve to go to prison. And this has destroyed my family life. It's destroyed my personal and professional life. But here I am to tell you that I am telling you the truth about Donald Trump, and Donald Trump needs to tell the truth about himself.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with political junkie Ken Rudin. He's on the phone, and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. If you want to join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jack on the line. Jack, what's your question?
Back to Mark Meadows, I want to know what your panelists feel about the response by Elijah Cummings, who said he is a close friend of his. To me, that was very dismaying, and given that Mark Meadows is an arch-conservative at the Freedom Caucus. And also, I want to ask your guests about just the concept of cognitive dissonance with Trump, that he actually gets support because he says things that are so contrary to what he had said before with regard to, like, Vietnam, not serving in Vietnam and being a chicken hawk, and also the Otto Warmbier thing with North Korea, that it almost becomes attractive that people feel that you can do something like that.
Great question, Jack. We appreciate the call. Thoughts?
Well, one thing, yes, I thought the relationship between Elijah Cummings, the African-American congressman from inner-city Baltimore, and Mark Meadows, the conservative Republican from North Carolina, well, I think their friendship may be a good testament to Elijah Cummings, because I thought he ran a very fair hearing. He's been in Congress for a long time, and he's obviously built up relationships. And I thought it was a credit to him that they have this relationship. I didn't like the fact that Mark Meadows said, well, you know, I have nieces and nephews who are black. I wasn't sure the point of that. It's just like, it sounds like some of my best friends are black.
Right.
I didn't like that at all. But that was interesting. But the other thing about this, I mean, this is vintage Donald Trump, not only so he can criticize Dick Blumenthal, call him Da-Nang Dick, when Donald Trump himself refused to or did everything he could to get out of service in Vietnam. It's like when Trump and Trump's people will attack Matt Gaetz, the Republican congressman from Florida, put out a tweet the day before the hearing, talked about, well, maybe we should learn about all your other girlfriends. And this is coming from a party that has defended Donald Trump time and time again for Stormy Daniels and other women over and over and over again. So there's a certain cult-like thing about Donald Trump. Look, forget about his what he's done as president, the tax cuts and the judges and all the things that conservatives rightly should feel excited about. There are other personal things, the hypocrisies and things like that, that would drive almost anybody else nuts. I mean, the thought of Rick Perry getting booted out of the presidential race because he couldn't think of a third cabinet of a department he would cut. And you have a president who talks about grabbing women and things like that, and half the country, or at least a good percentage of the country, will back him to the hilt.
Well, there does appear to be a different standard for this president as it relates to others. And it's somewhat reminiscent as if we got a first taste of this, Howard, in 2004, when Bush was running against Democrat John Kerry, who was by most accounts a hero in the Vietnam War, and then was attacked from the right for that service, even though, again, George Bush was someone who was able to avoid that conflict.
Right, and John Kerry was somebody who actually came back from Vietnam and opposed the war and spoke out against the war. But I know personally a lot of military people, people who served in the military as officers and enlisted men, many of whom earned the Purple Heart, who will defend Donald Trump to the hilt. And despite the fact, and they understand, they realize about, you know, the five bone spurs and the deferments and the fact that his father knew a podiatrist who was able to help get him out of the keep them out of the harm's way, but they still will not let him go.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jackie on the line. Jackie, what's your question? Hey, Jackie, are you there? Let's see if we can come back to her. We'll go to Eric. Eric, you're on the line. Eric, what's your question? Are we losing all of our callers? Eric, are you there? I feel like I can hear him, but that's all right. We want to jump to 2020 because we do want to talk about some of the candidates that are in the race. And the Democratic field for 2020 changed when Bernie Sanders decided that he is going to run again. Who does this impact the most in terms of all those Democrats who had already jumped in?
Well, you could say on paper, it probably affects those who share his left-wing philosophy, populist philosophy, but the people who are calling for Medicare for all, the $15 minimum wage, free tuition, and that's the Elizabeth Warren, perhaps Kamala Harris wing of the Democratic Party that is more to the left than, shall we say, Sherrod Brown, should he get into the race. So, but I think, I don't know if anybody hurts anybody else because Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders. He was the clear runner-up in 2016. He has his millions of supporters. He raises more money than anybody else. I think it's kind of unfair to say that he hurts Elizabeth Warren because I think every candidate brings something different to the field, and I think it's too early to say who hurts whom rather than what these people bring to the race. And I think Bernie Sanders does bring a lot to the race, even though he is 77 years old and perhaps a lot of his supporters are. I mean, we saw this week three of his top advisors from 2016 quit his effort. They a difference of opinion. Bernie Sanders has been criticized constantly for allowing sexism to go on in his 2016 campaign from some staffers. So, I mean, everybody seems to have pluses and minuses, and Bernie Sanders certainly has great strength as he joins the race.
Yes. Within 24 hours of Bernie announcing that he was going to run, he had raised $6
million. $8
million. Or I'm sorry, $8 million.
No,
that's right.
They kept updating the totals.
Updating the totals. That's a lot of money in 24 hours. But then, as Ken points out, three of his top advisors, one of whom I know very well, has Cincinnati connections.
Is that Ted Devine?
No, it's Mark Longabaugh.
Oh, right.
Walked out on him. Said, you know, there are differences of opinion here. Now, I'm hoping to have a conversation with Mark about that.
Because he's got, like you said, he has some local ties. He's somebody that.
Yeah, well, he ran for Congress against Steve Chabot in 1996. And he's been involved in many campaigns here.
Howard, that
elsewhere.
Was next week's trivia question, by the way.
Oh.
Thanks for ruining it.
Well, I got it right then.
I'm sure you'll come up with another one. Or maybe we'll give away a couple of buttons.
Yeah.
Okay, so
I got two in one day.
Before we talk about Sherrod Brown and get an update on where all that stands, I want to ask about Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who entered the race. And she's gotten some weird media attention for her alleged treatment of her staff. So much for Minnesota Nice. One instance that got a lot of traction was apparently on an airplane where a staff member was bringing her a salad to eat. He had forgotten the fork, and so she had to eat the salad with her comb. And after she was finished eating the salad with her comb, she made the staff member go wash it. What do we make of these stories that are coming out about Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar?
Well, I mean, I hate stories like that. First of all, they say, well, she has a temper. Well, I think there are a lot of male bosses who have tempers as well.
Yes. Yeah,
I wanted to ask if this is sexism at play.
Well, but having said that, we can't deny the fact that she does have more turnover than almost any other member of Congress, male or female. And, you know, this has been, you know, she says, look, I'm a very demanding boss. Now, I've met her once, and everybody I know who knows her says she's the most delightful person they've ever met.
Right.
Vin Weber, who's a Republican conservative from Minnesota, says that he's very, very close with her and gives her advice, all that thing, and even though they're ideologically apart. But when you read those things over and over again, you just, I hate reading those things. It's like saying that, well, Elizabeth Warren isn't likable enough. And I keep hearing those stories, and it seems to be aimed more at women than men.
Yes.
But again, you still can't deny, you can't avoid hearing what you hear about Klobuchar and her temperament.
I don't like hearing these things either, particularly. I mean, we had a male congressman from this area for many years who had a incredible temper and used to take telephones off his desk and throw them at staff
members. Let's hear it.
Well, he's passed away.
Well, then he won't mind.
Yeah, Tom Lucan.
Oh, sure. Okay, of course.
And Tom Lucan used to do that. He had a very volatile temper. Now, you know, nobody, of course, he didn't run for president. You know, but he...
And he didn't make you wash his comb.
No, he didn't. Absolutely, no. Right.
So Sherrod Brown, Democrat from Ohio, it looks like his trip around the early states is either over or just about over. Howard, what do you think he's thinking about now that he's hit those corners?
Well, I'm convinced that he's going to take a shot at this, at least through the first, you know, few debates.
And the good news in terms of his temperament is he doesn't look like someone who owns a comb, so he's not going to
be
eating
a comb. Right, exactly,
any salad.
Used one since, you know, 1973, so, you know.
Or eating a salad, right.
that's true.
So you think he's going to jump in.
I do.
So this field is really getting big.
Because he has an appeal that can kind of go to both ends of the party, the populist end of the party. He can talk to those people. He can talk to the millennials. He can talk to the business community. He does have, you know, footholds in all of these groups. And he may be able to have some pretty wide appeal. I don't know. He needs more.
There's also a geographic appeal because if you think of where Donald Trump won the election in 2016, and that was in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Iowa, he being from the Midwest, as Amy Klobuchar is, but he being from the Midwest maybe can do well. Now, you don't know what it is about white males. Every time I read about a story about Bernie Sanders or Mayor Pete from South Bend or Sherrod Brown, I say, well, he's a white male, Beto O'Rourke, who may be jumping in the race in the next week or so. Also, he's a white male. I never heard that being a criticism before of a presidential candidate, because most of our presidents, except for that guy from Kenya, no, I don't mean that. No, I don't mean – I do that as a
joke to Mark Meadows.
That was a joke.
Right, exactly. Right. No, I would never say that. But anyway, but I said it anyway. But I mean, everybody's been a white male, and so – it's just kind of remarkable that people say, but he's a white male. But when you think of the Kamala Harrises and the Tulsi Gabbards and the Cory Bookers and Amy Klobuchars, I mean, they are not white males. And it's just Elizabeth Warren. So it's kind of interesting what's going on.
Well, but Ken, you know, and Sherrod Brown, Donald Trump won Ohio with the very same voters that Sherrod Brown does very well with. In eastern Ohio, in the Mahoning Valley, up and down the Ohio River, those are his people, and they were Donald Trump's people in 2016.
And what I have a hard time understanding then is why weren't they Hillary Clinton's people? Where on the policy do Sherrod Brown and Hillary Clinton differ? Or are we getting back into identity politics where this was a female?
You're talking about the trade agreements. You're talking about tariffs. You're talking about also just the fact that Hillary Clinton wasn't there. She didn't go there. She didn't go talk to them. She didn't campaign among them. And that was a big, big problem in that campaign for her.
513-419-7100. If you have any comments, talk at WVXU.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. I want to jump into a couple of policy issues before our show ends here in the next few minutes. It seems to me that abortion is making a comeback for Republican politicians at the state and federal level. I know it never really went away. It's always there, but it's really being emphasized both in Washington and in our state capitals. Why the sudden emphasis on this issue again? We're talking about like some real late term abortion stuff where they've used the term infanticide and floating that around and passing some legislation or having votes on this legislation and calling out Democrats for opposing protections for these babies who some would characterize as being killed after surviving an abortion. Why this issue now?
I think it's basically a matter of trying to gin up a certain p- part of the Republican coalition, which would be the so-called values voters who kind of faded away and don't have the influence, haven't had the influence in the last several election cycles that they did, say, back in 2004, when they actually did win Ohio for George W. Bush because there was a ballot issue.
Same-sex marriage.
So, you know, they're trying to gin those people up again, get them excited and get them out for a Donald Trump or for Republican candidates.
They're already excited about Donald Trump, the evangelicals.
Yeah, but they're not – but they – honestly, when you talk to them, you talk to the leadership of them, and I've talked to a number of them here in Ohio, they feel like they've been ignored lately.
Okay.
And now they're getting attention again.
Any thoughts on that, Ken?
Something also, I think part of it is also, look, I don't think the issue has ever gone away, but the fact that it's now a Democratic Congress, I think this is a good target for the pro-life community and for President Trump to point to. They support abortion on demand. They support abortion in the 10th month. I mean, some of the rhetoric is beyond, but I think but by going after socialists and the Ocasio-Cortez wing of the party and the abortion rights people, I think this gives them, as Howard says, a chance to focus on their base. And while maybe evangelicals may have not been as enamored in 2018 as the president would have liked, it's an issue that keeps them close to the base, and I think it's very effective. I know, Michael, I know you want to go on to another subject. Can I just mention one thing quickly, because I think it's pretty remarkable? The Tuesday election in Chicago for mayor, there's going to be a runoff on April 2nd. Both candidates are black women. One is a gay black woman. And, of course, that's pretty remarkable for a city like Chicago, where Bill Daley, the son of the late mayor and the brother of another mayor, was favored to go into the runoff. Big result in Chicago.
Very unusual for someone with the last name Daley to lose an election in Chicago. Right. One last piece of policy I want to address in the last 90 seconds we've got together is the Green New Deal. Looks like Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell wants to force a vote in the Senate on this issue to try to pen his Democratic rivals into a corner on this issue. But do we even know what the Green New Deal is, or has this just become sort of some branding exercise and another thing that you're supposed to hate if you're a conservative and love if you're a liberal?
I think that's a pretty good description of what is going on right now, because it seems to me, at least, to Democrats, it means different things to different people.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very coherent. But one person that it's highly associated with is this freshman Democratic congresswoman from New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Exactly.
And conservatives, man, they are obsessed with AOC. Yep. So this seems to drive that. We've just got a minute left.
Plus the fact that when Nancy Pelosi said this whatchamacallit green thing, you know, she really didn't understand it. I think the Democrats are not united behind this at all.
No.
It could be extremely expensive. It could be reaching, you know, talking about full employment. I don't know how anybody thinks that'll work unless we're spending trillions and trillions of dollars. It's an important first step because green economy is the future, or we all die. But right now, not even the Democratic Party knows what it stands for.
Well, we all die. Let's end on that happy note. Appreciate it. Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Howard Wilkinson from WVXU, thanks for joining us as well. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.